Hello, faithful listener, and welcome to this Small Voice podcast. I'm Holly.
And I'm Darren. In this podcast, we will be reviewing the new movie Civil War, directed by Alex Garland.
And we'll be revisiting the topic of bereavement and grief, prompted by the recent paperback publication of Cariad Lloyd's book, You're Not Alone. We do like to keep things nice and breezy for you, so Civil War and bereavement in one podcast, we are spoiling you. But before all that, we should check in with each other. Darren, how have you been?
Remember, Holly, we used to ask if weeks or months had been heaven or hell? You know what? Monday this week, I had a small slice of heaven. You might recall that Jill and I have been trying to get along to some more live music. And we went to hear a small big band called the Century of Swing All-Star Band. Now, they're terribly white in English, but they can play. Now, there was one black singer, I should say, who was very, very good. But overall, the feeling was more Little Hampton than New Orleans. But, you know, they can play. And I got to hear, I'm a bit of a jazz buff, so I got to hear tracks like Benny Goodman's Sing, Sing, Sing and Duke Ellington's In a Mellow Tone, pretty much authentic arrangements. And I'm not sure I'll ever hear them live again. It's, you know, there are songs that you can hear anyone singing anytime, but these kind of big band arrangements are expensive to do and to do well. And, you know, fair play to the Century of Swing All-Star Band. Catch them at Christmas. But, you know, it was just lovely to... it was an old audience, let it be said. But it are was counting, lovely to be there.
Are you counting yourself among the old audience, or were you bringing the average age down?
I was probably, I was quartile three. If this were a box plot, Holly, that's one for the maths buffs who are fans of the podcast. What about you, Holly? How have you been?
So I'm a bit worried that people are going to think poorly of me, but because I started last podcast by talking about having just come back from holiday, and
you've not been on holiday again, have you?
You find me having just come back from holiday again, which is not my usual, but has been delightful. So a bit like yourself, I've been quite a cultured couple of weeks. My wife and I went down to London, not to run the marathon. She was at a big work conference about diabetes, and I tagged along because I wanted to have some fun. So we went to see Cabaret in the West End. I took myself to see the... there's a production of Nye at the National Theatre where Michael Sheen is starring as Nye Bevan, and just a couple of other bits and bobs too. And then we came back and went to see Hamilton in Edinburgh on Saturday. So I'm feeling terribly cultured. So since we last spoke, I think I've been to the theatre four times. So I'm good. I think sometimes you need that kind of holiday that is, it's not just about rest and relaxation. It's about kind of input and letting you really think about something that isn't what goes on in your day to day. So that was
absolutely.
That was the kind of break that I had. So I think that's we're both doing pretty well. That's not bad.
Yeah. And what about you, faithful listener? We'd love to hear how you're getting on. And it's always good to hear from you. So thanks to those of you who got in touch. A regular listener, Geraldine, responded to a recent podcast where we reviewed Marilyn Robinson's book about Genesis. Geraldine says, interesting as ever. Thanks, Geraldine. The check is in the post. But she does also say, Marilyn Robinson sounds way too scary and daunting for me.
Me too.
Geraldine goes on, I think Holly put her finger on part of the reason for our complicated relationship with the Bible. The Bible has been weaponized for many reasons and against different groups down the centuries. She points out, at my church, members of the congregation read several prescribed pieces for the Mass, and there are some passages that my female friends and I react to with, I'm nae reading that. Geraldine says, looking at you, St. Paul. She says, you're right about all the elements, cultural and religious too. And goes on to say that she loves the phrases that, like Shakespeare, are in the bricks of our cultural life. Don't you love the wine of astonishment and keeping someone as the apple of your eye, says Geraldine. And she says more, actually. So get onto Substack and you'll see all that. Or actually, I say Substack. I think it's on our website. Apologies. Had you heard of the wine of astonishment, by the way?
No, I hadn't. And then I read it and thought, is that Shakespeare or the Bible? Oh, I would do very badly in this round of a pub quiz.
I know that part of the Bible says, let the poor drink beer that they may forget their worries. Because a minister friend of mine was very keen to tell me about it. But I don't remember the wine of astonishment anyway.
Also, in reaction to our chat about Marilyn Robinson's book, a friend of the podcast, and you may remember Actual Scientist, Dr. Gavin, sent us a wee cartoon funny about Calvinism. Thanks, Gavin. We don't really, or we're not meant to really do Twitter/X or whatever we call it anymore, but we did sneak in and pick that up. And faithful listener Katrina caught up with our most recent podcast, Margaret's interview with therapy dogs. Well, I guess she didn't really interview the therapy dogs. She interviewed the owners. The dogs, which we do hear from too, just contributed a few snuffles and happy noises, which is nice. Well, anyway, Katrina says, such a wonderful small voice, full of hope, love and compassion. Thanks for sharing the story with us. Well, Katrina, it was our pleasure and a very rewarding small voice to highlight. I also met a therapy dog today and they are the best of animals.
Absolutely. So thanks again, faithful listeners, for your feedback. And you know where to find us if you want to contribute a thought or response, or indeed an idea for a small voice for us to highlight. Get in touch on our website at smallvoice.org.uk or on our Facebook page. And remember, we are on Substack as well for occasional extra stuff. Faithful listeners will know that one of our themes this year on the podcast is politics, kind of an obvious choice given the number of elections that are taking place across the world this year and our concerns of extremism and populism being on the rise, fueled at least in part by social media and AI. So when we heard that highly regarded author and director Alex Garland's new film called Civil War was set in modern day USA and dealt with a new US Civil War, well, we were pretty gosh darn excited. And the excitement continued to grow once we saw the trailer. So here's a clip.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Let me know if you want to try anything.
I'm guys aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on all across America.
We just try to stay out. With what we see on the news, seems like it's for the best.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
Mr. President, do you regret the use of airstrikes against American citizens?
We're moving to D.C. today.
We need to go down there.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol.
Every instinct in me says this is death.
Bloody.
Every time I survived the war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What?
Well, you're American, okay?
Okay. What kind of American are you?
So, as you've heard, against this backdrop of civil war, we followed the fortunes of world-weary war photographer Lee Smith, played by Kirsten Dunst, and Reuters journalist Joel, played by Wagner Moura, as they attempt to journey from New York to Washington, D.C., where they hope to get an interview with the president. I should say the journey from New York to Washington is a good deal harder than it would normally be. Pretty exciting trailer. So we're going to cut straight to the chase then, Holly. What did you think?
So I've got a very straightforward answer, which doesn't, I think, capture the whole of my experience. I loved this film, but I would hesitate to recommend anyone else to go to see it, because it is very much an assault to the senses. I went to see it in a little cinema in the West End of Glasgow. So folks in Glasgow be familiar with the Grosvenor Cinema. And it was a weeknight full of very well-behaved cinema goers. So everybody stayed to the end of the credits. So, had a little bit of conversation on our way out. And that was the overwhelming thing that people were saying was, gosh, wasn't that an awful lot? It was a really intense film, although quite short. That's my short answer. Maybe get into some of the nuances in a wee minute, but it was a very interesting and enjoyable is not the right word, but it was a good film. Darren, what did you think?
I really didn't like it, if I'm honest. I think I wanted to see a different film. I think I wanted to see a bit more of the film that's in the trailer. And to be fair, I understand that you market the film in a way that's going to catch people's attention, Civil War in America. But you know what? We're not really going to tell you that much about how the Civil War's come about. We'll talk about a third term president. We'll talk about who, but we will not say that it's Trump. We won't even say that it's a Republican. And we will have this odd kind of alliance between Texas and California, which is kind of the rebels. It's a bit weird because Texas is obviously Republican, California is Democrat, but, you know, be that as it may. And so I didn't feel I could get any meat out of how can we stop this happening in America. So the film became War is a Bad Thing, which I kind of know. Now, I guess the idea then is, but look, this is happening in America. And certainly there are scenes in the film where your reaction is, I think, gosh, you normally see this in a kind of banana republic somewhere that, you know, they're just rounding up people and shooting them. And I guess the point is this could happen here. But I want the tell me how it can happen here and warn us so that it doesn't happen, because otherwise I'm left with what is a pretty formulaic young person wants to be a war photographer, tags along with the war photographer's buddy movie, bang, bang, shooty, shooty, get to... It didn't engage me. I didn't even find it an assault. If I could... I'm not going to say if I could have got my phone out, I would have... But it didn't grab me.
So I'm fascinated by this. One, because we don't normally disagree to this extent about something. But two, because I was rapt. Like at one point I was like, I wasn't even sitting back in my seat. I was like sitting forward. There was no one sitting in front of me. I was like leaning on the row in front of me in the cinema to watch the film. So we clearly had a really different experience. I can't remember where I heard it now, but it must have been on a podcast or I think I heard it rather than read it this week. But someone said that if you went to see it expecting a political film, then people were inevitably disappointed, as in a film that had had related to politics, as they, because it's not an apolitical film. It is a film that has a point of view, but not about what is currently happening in America, which I think is a different thing. But if you went to see it for a war film, maybe you were not as disappointed. So I felt it was a film that shouldn't have worked for me, for lots of reasons. So basically, it takes things that you would associate with seeing on the news happening in countries where civil wars have happened. So primarily poorer countries and countries that are less, I guess, culturally familiar to those of us who live in the West. And it takes those scenes and just lifts them and directly places them in the States. And to be honest, that was the thing that didn't hugely work for me. I talked a wee bit about the lady that I was talking to on my way out of the cinema. And we talked about how much of an assault on the senses it was. And she said, oh, it really made me think. It was unbelievable, like, that something like that would happen here. And then there was this quite long pause. And I said, well, to be honest, I'm Northern Irish and there, but for the grace of God. And I found myself a little bit, I had that moment where I was kind of, even though I had really valued the film, that I was a wee bit annoyed that I was, doing my best Mark Kermode impression. Roger Ebert described film as a machine that generates empathy. And I felt if you had to have something shoved on your throat as like, look, it's happening in America, that it could happen to you to generate empathy, then that maybe cinema wasn't quite doing its doing its job.
Yeah. I think a frustration for me is that this movie, if it's caused outrage in Fox News, for example, in America, it's passed me by. And I think that's happened because it is a movie which does not name the big bad. Unless I'm very much mistaken, a civil war or a president who disrespects and kind of, you know, utilizes the military in what might be considered illegal ways. That's Donald Trump we're talking about, or someone like Donald Trump. But Alex Garland goes out of his way to not say. Now, I've seen interviews with him where he says, well, it's really, really obvious. You know what? Name it, Alex. Name the evil. Name what is in the room, because otherwise, why pull that punch? I think that was one frustration for me.
I can understand that point of view. I think the bit that... So there was a review in... there was a couple of reviews in The Guardian, one of which raved about it, and one of it was one of them didn't like it. And I enjoyed the fact that this is clearly a Marmite film. But in a review, Adrian Horton called it emotionally cold, which I thought was really unfair, because what I watched and what I experienced when I watched it wasn't a film about war, wasn't a film about politics, was a film about PTSD. And the Kirsten Dunst character, clearly, who is a war photographer called Lee, who has travelled covering wars through the world and has then come back to cover war in the United States, is clearly a person who is very psychologically troubled. And that was the film that I watched. The sound design pointed at PTSD, the visual design pointed at PTSD, her emotional coldness in some ways pointed at that. And I thought, as a film about this character's mental health, and also the moral ambiguity of sitting alongside horrible, awful things that are happening and just documenting them in a way that is in attempting to be dispassionate in some way, how much of a devastation that can wreak on a person. I think that's the film that I saw.
Yeah. I love being around people like you, Holly, who can go deep and see the good in things. This is a niche comment. This is a niche comment coming up. But if I sit and I think, you know, Kirsten Dunst could totally play Emily Saliers in a biopic of Indigo Girls. I told you it was a niche comment. And if I also sit here and go, oh, here we go. Here's Jesse Plemons turning up as the creepy guy, because sadly Philip Seymour Hoffman's no longer with us. But, you know, he's the kind of knockoff Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And also
nasty guy.
And also married to Kirsten Dunst. So,
oh, I didn't know that. There you go.
which I guess that makes some sense of that.
He's a little bit cheaper. But I think I could see the pieces joining together. Mm. I don't want to give away the plot.
No.
But you talk about PTSD, and I in a way I thought it was going down that route, and I take your point, but then the film doesn't quite resolve in the way. There's one other, you know, the famous, so we're referencing Mark Kermode here, there's a good gag about some thriller with Liam Neeson where they ask who's driving the boat. My question, if you go and see this film, is basically a Wagner Moura's character, Joel, why is he there? He doesn't have a camera in his hand. He's running around where there's bullets being fired, and I have no idea why he's there. But that's just me picking at it, I guess, because it didn't engage me.
Okay, I mean, I'm interested in that, and I, I, as I said, I would find it difficult to recommend folks saw it. So I guess maybe that's the question, is who is this film for? And given that we normally land on a similar side of a lot of media stuff, should our listener go to see it or not?
I think go and see it with someone else so you can have a good chat about it afterwards. You know what? What's fascinating though, Holly, is you picking up on Northern Ireland. You know, I feel kind of tone deaf for not thinking. You know, my mind didn't even go anywhere near that, which probably talks about my constituted existence, you know, in Scotland, as if seemingly unaware of what was going on, you know, very close by and in the news all the time when I was growing up.
Yeah, the Northern Irish press this week are reporting quite a lot on the delays to the trial of the people that killed Lara McKee, who was a journalist that was killed in Northern Ireland in 2019. So I guess that's partly why that's in my head. Mm-hmm. I would say don't go to see it expecting a blockbuster. Don't go to see it expecting a film that has a commentary about what's currently happening in politics, and because I think you will be disappointed. But if you go to see it about, then you're wanting to see a film, which I guess many people probably aren't, wanting to see a film about PTSD and moral ambiguity in reporting, then maybe that's the film for you. It's not a date night film.
No. I have to say, let it be said, our DMs are open. We are available, faithful listeners, for your reactions to the film if you have seen it. We hope that you think it's certainly worth talking about. Mm. And heavens, it's everywhere. Civil War is directed by Alex Garland, as we said, and it is in cinemas now.
So earlier in this podcast, Darren mentioned that we have some overarching themes for the podcast for the year. Now, for faithful listeners, this may come as a surprise because I imagine you all think that we just make this up on the spot. So if you're paying attention, we've mentioned politics, we've mentioned technology, and we have a broader topic of, living with grief, a little bit about, the human condition and spiritual practices. Cariad Lloyd's book, You're Not Alone, has recently been published in paperback. The subtitle of her book is A New Way to Grieve. And some of you may know Cariad Lloyd from her long-running podcast, Griefcast, in which she got various folks like comedians, authors, musicians to come on and to talk about a person that they loved who had died. And to talk about what their grief was like for that person or for other griefs that they'd experienced in their life. Griefcast was a rip-roaring success, and we maybe talk about that a little bit later on. But at the start of each episode, Cariad asked each of her guests, who are we remembering today? So maybe that's a good place for us to start too. Darren, who are you remembering today?
Holly, if we're talking about grief, then... and I guess, like Cariad's guests, you go to the one that is biggest for you. So for me, we are remembering George William McKinnon, Bill McKinnon, my dad, who died on the 2nd of January 1995 at 10 past 7 p.m. And I did not have to look that up. I had to do a calculation on the year, because I knew it was the year that I turned 30, but Dad didn't get to see my third birthday. He died of lung cancer. I noticed that Cariad Lloyd, who, lost her father a good deal younger than me, but she writes in the book, "I can chart my life before my dad died and after my dad died. I can split my life into two, the cut slicing my own narrative. This is the point where I understood." She says, "This is where I joined the club, the grief club. For me, it's when I grew up. I grew up the day that my dad died, basically."
Yeah.
As in my life changed. It just was different from that point on.
So I speak, and I think Cariad Lloyd's dad died when she was 15. And I speak from a really privileged position in this regard, in that I have not just both of my parents, but a couple of spare parents. I've got some some step parents. I've still got all four, and I have a grandparent still with us. Two of my grandparents died before I was really old enough to remember them. I'm going to share a person who just has been on my mind a hell of a lot over this last few weeks, for whatever reason. That is that I am remembering Deborah White, Debbie White, who was my dear friend who died way, way too young from a brain tumour. And she was incredible. She was an absolute firecracker. And I think I've been thinking about her a lot recently for loads of reasons. But one was that a few months ago we read the book For Thy Great Pain, Have Mercy on My Little Pain about Julian of Norwich and Marjorie Kemp. And Debbie was a medievalist, and she introduced me to both of those women before I read that book. So that's one of the reasons why she's in my mind. But I've been thinking a lot about my friends who have left this earth way too soon over this last few weeks, And I think part of that, I guess, is because of my job. So regular listeners may remember that I'm a palliative care doctor, and I'm looking after a few younger folks at the minute, and that does bring up some griefs that are I guess they're not like normally at the forefront of my mind, but they come up often enough.
Yeah.
So Darren, you mentioned there your dad with, you know, a striking amount of detail about that moment at which things changed for you. Don't mean to age you or to date you, but it wasn't yesterday.
No, it wasn't. You know, and I'm fast approaching the point where my dad will have been dead for half of my life. You know, my dad died when he was 59. There's a bit of black humour in the McKinnon family over this. My mum made it to 60 and then died. My mum had very bad asthma, so we didn't expect mum to necessarily last that long. So she died, I think, 5 or 6 years after my dad. She made it to her 60th birthday and then died. I know we're not reviewing Carrie Ad's book, but I find it's really important that people have a chance to talk about grief, I think. And I think a book like You Are Not Alone. I don't like the subtitle, by the way, and I wouldn't blame her on that. You know, A New Way to Grieve. I don't think it is particularly, but you know, I think a book about grief that's written by someone who's younger, and a podcast which has interviews with people, so that you can tell that no matter who this famous person is, they have experienced grief. You know, they have lost someone. I think that's really, really helpful, and I would have found it helpful at the time. I think, particularly, you know, when my dad died, it was the most important thing. You know, if I was meeting someone, it kind of defined me. It was like the most important thing for them to know about me. It's not like I was going to tell them that, but it was just kind of hugely important. And then I remember thinking that my dad wouldn't want me to define myself in terms of him dying, you know. But I think around about the time that I had that moment of clarity, my mum died shortly after, so it wasn't quite so good. But for me now, the grief about my dad dying, it's not like Carrie Ad Lloyd. I mean, she talks about how it can still hit her viscerally. I would say that I'm comfortable now in terms of remembering my dad, and even quite soon after his death, maybe choosing, if that's the right word, you're the expert, you'll tell me, but choosing to remember the life rather than the end of it.
So I think everyone's everyone's different. I was introduced to Carrie Ad Lloyd through Griefcast, the podcast. So that was something that was recommended to me, and it was recommended to me quite late in its run by my sister-in-law. And my sister-in-law had had a friend die in her 20s in really, really sad circumstances. And my sister-in-law, Lizzie, is she's not so, or she wasn't at that time so good at talking about how she was feeling. And I think what you said about Carrie Ad Lloyd writing this book and doing the podcast as a younger person, I think was really helpful. Like, to have somebody who you could relate to talking about these topics was really helpful. Even when all the people that are on the podcast, they're maybe talking about a completely different range of people that have died, there was something about each of those episodes that meant a lot to her. And she used to do a job that was quite manual, and she would just listen to it at work several times in the day. She would just pick up episodes. I guess particularly struck by the ones that were about losing friends. It was something that she recommended to me after our friend and our friend Anne, who used to present this podcast with us after Anne died. Lizzie said, I wonder whether you would, I know that you do grief and bereavement as part of your job, but I do wonder whether listening to just some normal non-death professionals talking about grief would be something that would be helpful for you. And actually, you know, she was right. There was a time that I found that really useful. And then I guess there was a time when then that wasn't so useful anymore, but it was a good tool to exist. And I'm a fan of Carrie Ad Lloyd, and I read You're Not Alone when it first came out. And I think it's something that it certainly went into my repertoire of like books that I have in my office that, you know, for the right person, that would be the book that you would give them. And I think certainly if this is a topic that interests you, or you've been bereaved, no matter when that was, whether that was recently or whether it was ages ago, if it's something that still really sits with you, it is a book that is worth a read. It's certainly part, as I said, part of my repertoire of books.
She introduced me to the concept of SADMIN, by the way, which was a new one on me, but such an obvious one, the administration that has to be done when someone dies. Is that a normal phrase, Holly, or was that?
It's not, I mean, I've heard it called lots of things. I had this patient that I looked after years ago who was amazing, and I can't tell you what she called death admin. So she... she was kind of my age now. She was older than me than the age I was when I knew her. But she would designate one day of the week as a day when she would do all of the stuff you need to do whenever you're grappling with your own death. And afterwards, they would get a takeaway and open a bottle of wine and try and forget about it for a wee while. And she called it F It Friday. And It is a concept that I introduced to loads of my patients, particularly younger ones, to be like, you know, actually, there's just some stuff that you're going to have to do that is not good stuff to do. And sometimes spreading it out is good, and sometimes just putting it in its box and opening the box once a week is a good way to do it. But I think SADMIN is a lovely turn of phrase. And I think we're all familiar with that thing whenever somebody dies and it's your world is ripped from its axis, and you have to make a lot of phone calls for some reason. That's not, it feels like something cosmic is happening and then something utterly mundane is happening at the same time, and I don't think there is anything in life quite as weird.
When my dad died, I mean, obviously we were kind of young in terms of registering his death and so on. You know, my brother and I were dealing with that, in our 30s or just about. So it's not like I had a spreadsheet But I think it'd be awful to someone dies. I just describe how your life is now never going to be the same again, and then suddenly you're going down a checklist of things to do. But you know what? Maybe a checklist of things to do is actually really, really helpful.
I mean, the booklet that we hand out in hospitals and hospices is literally called What to Do After a Death in Scotland.
Yeah.
And it is, that's what people need. They need someone to take them by the hand and to lead them through some of this stuff, because it's not, you'll always forget something. And actually, if you forget to do something, you forget to tell somebody, then you're kind of setting yourself up for some sort of horrible assault in the future, where you suddenly get a piece of post through the door and or a phone call from somebody and they don't know. And I don't know. It's one of those things. I think my advice that I often give to families is, if there's somebody who relishes that stuff, you know, who actually just needs something to do, they just need to sit down somewhere with a to-do list and make themselves busy.
Is that a Martha rather than a Mary?
To allow that person to just crack on with some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Or if you're a friend of someone who has recently been bereaved, actually offering to take some of this stuff off their plate if you can do it. Because some that you can't, it has to be the next of kin. But actually some of that boring stuff, like, anybody could do if they've got the right information. So I think sadmin is maybe an important thing to remember. But I guess there's other, you know, how do you sit alongside that kind of sadmin side of things and then the tectonic plates of your life shifting side of things, and then you're just walking around in the world and nobody knows what's going on with you. There's I think it was in Richard Cole's book, The Madness of Grief, about the loss of his husband. He talks about, you know, walking around in the hospital when David was dying, and that people would recognise him from being on the telly, or they would recognise him as being a minister locally and would be asking him questions, so being the local vicar. And he felt that he just kind of wished he could have a big neon flashing sign to tell people what was going on.
Yeah. And does that take us on to... well, you could talk about things like rituals in terms of grieving for people, because I noticed that Carrie Ad Lloyd, she on the podcast, I think she ended up getting someone to make her a little badge. Was it? I mean, you might know this better than I do, Holly. There was a badge, and she ended up ordering them for quite a few people because they were keen on it. It was a little badge that dead basically dads. Meant that you were bereaved.
Yeah, well, she did have one that said the Dead Dads Club.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, there was some appetite among some people for like some sort of visual indicator. Not quite as intense as a flashing sign, but one that just sort of marked a person out in society, almost like whatever the modern version of mourning wear would be.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting, but I think it did speak to that weirdness as you try to integrate loss into your day-to-day life. Sometimes you're just in a supermarket and having the worst day of your life at the same time, and that doesn't quite, I think we all want things to be a little bit more linear than that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was struck by the kindness of the people, I guess, who like yourself, Holly, are kind of in the I was going to say in the death industry. I know you're care at end of life is slightly different, but you know, so from the GP, my dad died at home. That's what he wanted. So from the GP, and of course the district nurse who was visiting and giving him care, medication, but from the GP after my dad died. And absolutely from the funeral directors and the undertakers who came, I have nothing but admiration for what they did and for how good they were at looking after us in their own small way. You know, I wouldn't recognise the chap who came, there were two of them, of course, you know, to take away the body, but I wouldn't recognise him if I saw him in the street. But he was just so good and so helpful.
Funeral directors are absolute heroes. I would say, I think they're They are a group of professionals that are probably hugely underrated. Obviously, there's been recent stories in the press about some somewhat dodgy operations. Mm-hmm. It's not a regulated profession, but good funeral directors are among the best of us, I think. And I know that you'll find that, you know, we know in the hospice who the good funeral directors are, because the nurses will tell you how much respect they have for people and how they treat our patients after they've died. And that's what I look for. I look for that level of care. Like, I always teach medical students and junior doctors, it doesn't matter what you believe about life after death. Whenever you walk into a room with a person who has died, you speak to that person, because mm-hmm. that will remind you that you are talking to and caring for a human being. And that helps you as a person who is doing this for a job to not go crazy and lose your humanity whenever you're dealing with a lot of death. And I've been that junior doctor on a night shift, knackered, asked to go in to verify someone's death, and thought about it as another boring job. And I didn't like that side of myself. Mm-hmm. And I think finding ways to humanize that, and I think the same for funeral directors, like finding ways to, little rituals and little ways to humanize the care of dead people is a really important thing.
And so what do we think then of the rise of what's referred to as, is it direct funerals or direct cremation?
Ho-ho.
I mean, that's been in the news a little bit. I mean, I was having a look at this, and it's hard to get statistics, of course, because funerals were entirely different during COVID. And of also the people that quote funeral statistics are often, you know, insurance companies. So I'm never entirely sure how much you can trust. But I came across some figures that were, for example, the cost of a traditional funeral is just under 4,000. A direct cremation in 2022 is about 1,500. I don't want to be flippant here, but direct cremation is a bit like kind of go to jail, go directly to jail, do not pass go. You circumvent the funeral part. Is that right?
Yeah. So I want to be clear, I guess, before we get into this conversation, that we're not going to talk about some of the recent news coverage of the legacy funeral directors in England, and because that is a separate thing. Although it has some it does have some aspects that are crossover, but we're not going to talk about that. It's more just about what do direct cremations, if there is no funeral, what does that do for the people that are grieving, I think, more than anything else. So I would say I'm interested. The people that I've looked after who don't want a funeral are people who are really, really pissed off about the fact that they're dying, and that it's about them. They want to control something. Or sometimes it's financial, but oftentimes it's not even financial. It's just, I don't want a funeral. As if a funeral is for the person that has died and not for the person that is left behind.
But it's very hard for the family, isn't it? Because you want to feel that you're respecting them. In fact, we're encouraged to plan our funeral. So.
Yeah, and we're really encouraged to respect our wishes. We use a document in work that has a little quote on the front of it, which is, this is my funeral plan, please respect my wishes, because obviously the person who's died, the people who are left behind, who are planning the funeral, can just choose to completely ignore that if they want to. So there's a little plea on the front of it to please respect it. But I think it is really hard for families whenever the deceased has said that they don't want a funeral, because funerals perform a function in terms of allowing us to say goodbye to the people that we love. And I do think the rise of direct cremation, I do worry about the impact it has on bereavement. I had a patient who was dying, who had a parent that died as they were dying, and the parent chose to have a direct cremation, and it really impacted my patient, who was also dying, that they didn't feel like they got to say goodbye. And I've heard that from other folks who've been in this, who either there just hasn't been a funeral at all, or there's been a direct cremation. I guess there's also a bit, I always think it all strikes me as a bit of an American thing, that there's a bit of a trend towards having a sort of Thanksgiving for somebody's life where there's no body and there's no coffin and there's no, there's, death is kind of pushed to the side a bit in the funeral. I do think there's something primal in us as human beings where actually we kind of need to say goodbye. And there's a reason why funeral customs across the world have kind of evolved to have quite a lot of similarities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it worries me that people are doing this because of cost. I mean, that's really appalling to think of that. And I was thinking of, actually go back to my dad's funeral, and I give a little example of why a kind of Thanksgiving for my dad wouldn't have been quite the same. And that, I guess that's that, I don't know what people do now actually, but back in the 1990s, I guess people were professional perusers of death notices. And my mum, in the lineup at the end of my dad's funeral, met a neighbour from upstairs, from the house that I first lived in. We would have left that house in something like 1969. And I swear my mum will not have seen that person since then, but they saw that death notice and they came to that funeral. And there's no way that you could organise a kind of Thanksgiving in the same way, or maybe I'm just kind of old fashioned, but there's something really good, I think, about it being public.
Yeah. And I
think, like weddings.
Yeah, I think good, like the word good is a word that comes up for me again and again and again when I talk about my experiences of bereavement and loss. Because it's not, you know, when you go to see someone, whenever you meet up with friends or you go to see a family member and someone has died, it isn't nice to see that person, but it is good to see that person. It is good to be together. It is good to, funerals are a good thing. They are not a nice thing, but they are a good thing, and we should be together and we should find a way to say farewell in a way that is meaningful and humane. I think that trying not to lose humanity is a hugely important thing. What about you, Darren? Have you got any funeral plans?
I was about to ask you that first.
I'll go first.
It's like I laughed in Carrie Ads Lloyd book when she points out that she hasn't got a will yet, or at the time that she wrote the book. And I've got a will. I haven't made a funeral plan. I remember my wife's mother and aunt, I think, doing something about, you know, writing down what they wanted their funeral to be. And honestly, that would have been about 20 years ago, so it wouldn't be far off the age that I now am. So I probably need to realise that I should do that. At heart, I don't want to say I'm not sure I'm terribly bothered. It is for the people grieving, you know. I trust the person who will be organising it. But having said that, and this might make you smile, Holly, but, you know, probably Mr. Blue Sky will have to be in there somewhere.
So my family, I don't talk about death and dying an awful lot, but I've known since I was a child that my mum wanted Mr. Blue Sky by ELO played at her funeral.
Go your mum.
And we're recording this at the beginning of May. And I heard today on the radio on the way home in the car that Richard Tandy, who's best known as the keyboardist of ELO, died yesterday. And I did think I'll need to make sure if we're talking about funerals and that we mention ELO, because I feel like Mr. Blue Sky is a cracking song to have at your funeral. I have to say, I agree with you. I think funerals are for the people who are left behind. I would
and
really
have you organised yours?
No, I have not. And I would love, I think folks who know me well enough would know exactly what I would want. I think I've got a bookmark in the page in the right book if somebody can find it, but I want, if I can put stipulate this in a will, I would like nobody to say anything at my funeral that I don't believe. I don't want anyone to talk about sure and certain hope of the resurrection from the dead, because I don't have sure and certain hope about anything, unless that's what the people who are there need to hear. But my one thing that I have a very strong opinion about is I've always wanted someone to sing the parting glass at my funeral, the Irish song. So all the comrades ere I had, they're sorry for my going away, and all the sweethearts ere I had, they'd wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I'll gently rise and softly call good night and joy be to you all. I talked about going to see some musicals when I was down in London, and one of them I went to see, it was a recommendation of a friend from church. I went to see something called The Choir of Man, which is about a pub that has a choir. And it's just a daft, short jukebox musical, and it pulls at your heartstrings a little bit, but it's nothing exciting at all. And then at the end, these fellas talk about men's mental health and talk about men who've died by suicide, and they turn their microphones off and sing The Parting Glass a cappella at the end of the at the end of the show, which absolutely destroyed me. And then I got back and I was talking to one of my friends from work, and she was saying that that's what they had at her brother's cremation. And she doesn't know whether she would have been be able to get up and walk out of the theatre after hearing that. So maybe we can all just choose one song. Palliative care doctors and nurses are a bit odd. The Scottish Partnership for Palliative Care Conference asks you what your funeral song is whenever you're speaking at it, and they used to, and they would play it for you as your music as you were getting up to come to the stage, because we're all a little bit morbid. But anyway, if you're looking to plan your own funeral, there are excellent resources, and sometimes people think it's a bit of work that they can take away from the people that they love who have been left behind. Talk about it. It's a good thing to, it's an excellent conversation to have with your family. I'm sure they'll all be delighted if you could listen to the podcast and then sit them down at dinner and say, what are we having at our funerals, friends? Maybe not. Anyway.
And maybe faithful listeners can tell us what music they'd have at their funeral.
Yeah, absolutely. Give us some ideas. You're Not Alone by Carrie Adloyd is published by Bloomsbury and has recently come out in paperback. And as we said, it's certainly worth a read. And I would also recommend going back and finding some episodes of Griefcast, which has sadly now come to an end, but certainly still worth a listen. Anyway, faithful listeners, as we'll leave you to plan your funerals, but we'll be back in your ears next month with more ponderings on matters moral, ethical, spiritual, funeral. Until next time, goodbye for now.
Goodbye, folks.